Hello and welcome to another episode of And the Winner Is, where we take a stroll back through the Best Picture winners at the Oscars. This month's second episode is all about the 1986 release Platoon, directed by Oliver Stone. Joining me as always is Paul. You're on my
Hello. Mind? Yep, all good. Looking forward to talking this one.
Yeah. This is one I've been waiting for a while, actually, since we've done it. So we shall dive into it in a moment. Once I've got me bearings. Otherwise known as Mark Kermo says, man looks at something on computer.
Yeah, definitely.
Yeah. So, as I say, this was released at the back end of 1986, December 19th, 1986, in the US. They had a budget of $6 million. Do you want to hazard a guess at the box office?
I reckon it did quite well. I'm going to say about 230 million.
Well, you're 100 over, apparently. 138 million.
Really? Blimey.
Yeah. That's still a nice bit of change.
Yeah, it is. I just expected it to have done more.
That's not worldwide, of course. That was domestic, that was. So yeah. That was H-side. That's still a decent haul. The film was nominated for 8 Academy Awards at the 59th Academy Awards and won 4 of them in the end. Best Picture, obviously. Best Director, Best Sound, and Best Film Editing. I couldn't argue with any of those, I don't think. The sound is very good, actually. So. The films it was up against that year, as we always try to cover, were... Let me have a look. Preparation is the key, as always, isn't it? To these things. we've been at work, haven't we?
Yeah, so, yeah. This is how we do it. We get on the fly. There's nothing better than being on the fly.
Anyway, yeah, so that year it was up against, it was one of the years with, unlike our last one, it was one of the small years with only 5 nominees. It was up against Children of a Lesser God, Hannah and Her Sisters, The Mission, and Room with a View. And this is one of those years where I have not seen 1, 2, 3. Well, I haven't seen any of the other 4, I don't think. I really need to rectify that.
I felt like I've seen A Room with a View.
Yeah, I've seen bits of Hannah and Her Sisters, and I really do need to watch The Mission, so I need to get onto these at some point. So for once, I can't even really comment whether it was worthy of the win, what it was up against.
Yeah.
But yeah, so that is unusual that we've not seen at least one of the other ones. I should just say this is the year that Paul Newman won for Colour of Money and Best Actor.
Yeah.
And amazingly, Sigourney Weaver was nominated for Best Actress for Aliens.
Yeah, I was going to say it must be Aliens.
Yeah, yeah. So that was quite interesting. That was just an interesting little side I spotted there.
And considering how we talk about like genre movies not really being looked at by the Academy, kind of looked down at. Yeah. Even going back that far, we're still seeing, and that's a big thing for it to be a female as well in a genre picture to be nominated is amazing.
Because there's been a handful, and there was Alec Guinness, of course, of Star Wars, and I think there were 1 or 2 others, but it's not that common for the popcorn films to get sort of
and really the big first one was kind of Heath Ledger.
Mm. So 1 or 2 other bits and pieces about the film. According to Oliver Stone, he intentionally cast Tom Berenger and William Defoe against type. Yeah, which I get, because normally you would see those two guys in the other sort of role.
Yeah.
Berenger obviously was famous for playing good guys, and Defoe would primarily play villains up until then. And they both got Oscar nominations for their work on the film. And they're both very good in it, actually.
Yeah, well, for me, it's Defoe's film. For the most part.
Another quite a sad one of them, but also uplifting as well. The Vietnamese child that Kevin Dillon and Charlie Sheen torment apparently had cataracts, but his family couldn't afford to pay for his treatment, and reportedly Dillon and Sheen felt so bad that they pulled money together so he could have surgery, which is pretty cool.
Doesn't surprise me with Kevin Dillon at all.
Yeah. Apparently, Stone wrote the first draft of the film in 1971, and he sent it to Jim Morrison in hopes he would play the Charlie Sheen part. And apparently Morrison had the script on him when he was found dead in Paris.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Interesting. Didn't know that. And then, of course, Oliver Stone went on to direct the film about him.
And another film I need to rewatch at some point.
Yep. Which also starred Kevin Dillon.
Yes, it was. Now, apparently, there are special packs of Marlboro cigarettes were made for the film on the insistence of Stone, who wanted the cherry red colour on the pack to more closely match the ones made during the 60s. So he was blowing that pot budget there.
Yeah.
This one that made me tickle. Some of the Vietnamese cast members were actually tourists who were vacationing in the Philippines at the time because the film was shot there. And the Vietnamese villagers were played by real Vietnamese refugees who were living in the Philippines. So that was quite fortunate for them. They could source actual Vietnamese in that other location. And the other one is one that seems to pop in a lot of these films. Before shooting commenced, all the actors had to undergo an intensive two-week basic training in the Philippines under the supervision of military advisor Dale Dio, of course, who appears in the film as well. Stone's intention was to not have the men bond and act as one unit, but to deprive them of sleep and make them so utterly exhausted they'd be burnt out and therefore in character. That seems to be a common thing with war films.
Yeah.
They like to have boot camps, don't they? Even things like Top Gun, they sent them all off to like training camp together and things
yeah,
like that.
And kind of look what happened to Charlie's dad on the set of Apocalypse Now. He ended up having a heart attack.
Yeah.
And because of how far he'd been pushed.
Yeah. And the directors seem to love sending all their cast off to boot camps. There was one famously, one of those recent war films where they didn't send the lead off. Oh, it might have been Matt Damon in Private Ryan.
Yeah.
If memory serves, Spielberg didn't put him on the boot camp because it would create that little bit of alienation.
Yeah.
If memory serves, from the guys that were supposed to be rescuing him.
Yeah, and that it's unbelievable how Spielberg's still going with these kind of war films and TV series, because obviously Masters of Air's just come out, which is another follow-up to the likes of Private Ryan and Band of Brothers and that group of things. So it's unreal how it's still an ongoing love.
And it's something that the Academy loves as well. I mean, we had a war film we did last month, of course.
Yeah.
In the Hurt Locker, and we've got this one again this month, and we've got at least one more I can think of to come in the form of Patton to do at some point. So, yeah, so anyway, I suppose we can just jump into the film. I should say that this is one that I actually managed to pull a DVD off the shelf I've had for years.
Yeah, where did I watch it? I think it was on Amazon Prime.
Yeah.
If I remember rightly. And it was part of the description. What is wrong with my speaking? Subscription. There we go. My brain is not engaging with my mouth. Description, prescription, subscription. That was what I was looking for.
Pre or post adverts?
No, it was post.
Yeah.
I got an advert 20 minutes in.
There we go. Right before a key scene of it.
Yeah.
Anyway, yeah, so the film drops us straight into the action, of course, with Charlie Sheen arriving on the scene. And that first thing he's greeted with is a bunch of body bags. They thought, I'd written down, this film's already grim.
yeah, that was very much what I said, that it's very bleak from the word go. But my question is, other than the fact that he went bloody mental, what caused Charlie Sheen to go from a film like this to comedy? I don't understand where that change came.
Well, I guess he kind of had a funny kind of career after this. I mean, because he did one or two, didn't he? Comedy, because he was into the Major League franchise.
Yeah.
He played the short-sighted guy, didn't he?
Yeah.
So he was in the first two or three of those for starters in the early 90s, and the Hot Shots films, of course.
Yep, obviously, and then obviously his career went to TV after that.
Yeah,
but it was all comedy.
Because didn't he replace Michael J. Fox in
Spin City?
Spin City as well. He did, so.
Yeah.
He kind of just drifted. It seemed to have drifted into it in the back end of the 90s. And then there are one or two sort of stuff he did with his brother, like Men at Work.
Yeah.
A comedy film we did where he played the sort of dustbin man. and the sort of like, and he did an action film with Clint Eastwood called, I think, The Rookie.
Yeah.
So he kind of just seemed to suddenly veer into the more light comedy stuff. And you don't really think of him after this film or do much in the way of drama, do you, actually? Really?
No, not at all. And it just seemed really strange that you went from, like, and he is the lead in this film. He's the one that's plastered over the posters. And
it's through his eyes we follow the story as well.
Yeah. So to go from leading a Best Picture winner to then pretty much just giving up straight acting, I didn't understand it.
No, especially with the background, of course, with his dad as well, and his dad is quite first.
And the other one as well, we've not talked about, Miss John McGinley, who did the same. Mm. Obviously, he's now more well known for being in Scrubs,
yes,
than anything.
Yeah.
So he was another one that went kind of the same way.
Mm. Yeah. So we go back into the film on this one. The other thing I'd written down in this early sequence as well, this jungle feels really sweaty.
You literally can feel the humidity coming off the screen.
It's sweaty and grimy.
Yeah, you're just like, I really wouldn't want to be near these people.
No.
For my sanity and theirs.
Yeah. I'd also read down this, but we've mentioned already. Dale Dye, what a career! That bloke is just any war film you think of. He just in this from the '80s on when he pops up, doesn't he?
Yep, and he's
a real
he's still going. I still hear him mentioned all the time.
Yeah, he's had a real great doubles career though, hasn't he? That sort of advisor and appearing on screen as well.
Yeah,
what you do? You want to, if you want to convince your military man, you just cast one.
Yeah.
Makes sense in some way. So, and it's, so I suppose it's handy to have him in shot as well and on set permanently then as well, isn't it? So,
yeah.
We mentioned as well at the start, seeing Defoe and Berenger is quite early on in their careers are quite sort of startling to see these sort of younger guys. In fact, generally the cast is just fantastic throughout. Tony Todd's in there.
Yeah, and apparently it was his debut.
Yeah, wow. Johnny Depp, of course, is in there as well.
Who gets one line in the whole film, and it's in a foreign language.
Disappears halfway through.
Yeah, his one line is in a foreign language.
Yeah.
And that's it.
Yeah. Forrest Whitaker as well is in there.
Yeah.
Keith David. And it is a really good cast of 80s cast, like you say, of debuts and people who've been around for a while. And I think that's one of the strengths of the film is these bunch of guys that they put in that jungle. And you care about their story and you care about them and their fates. And you've got McGinley in that as well, in there, in that sort of ever so slightly comedic role, even though in this there is this element of comic relief about him, isn't there, in this as well?
Yeah.
There's a bit later on in the film where he's trying to get out of going on a mission, isn't there? He wants to go home.
Yeah, yeah.
And he gets promoted.
Yeah. And obviously, we've come to know some of these actors for different roles. And obviously, Kevin Dillon, for me, I obviously knew his brother. His brother's had a bigger career. We can't deny that. But Kevin is superb. And for me, he was in one of my favourite TV shows of all time. He was in Entourage. He was one of the main cast members in that. Still to this day, he's...
The Blob at the back end of the 80s as well. He was in that remake.
Yeah. And as we mentioned, he was in The Doors. He played the drummer in The Doors, which he couldn't drum at the time. He learned. Entourage was a massive thing for me, and up until recently they've been doing a podcast with two of the cast members and the showrunner, and he's been great on that. He does a lot for charity, goes off and plays charity golf matches and all sorts of things, and has actually just started doing we've been talking about a convention over in Orlando between the two of us, MegaCon. And the whole cast of Entourage were there, including Kevin.
Wow.
So it's brilliant. He's still around. He's still going strong. He's still working. Mm. I believe he was in Bruce Willis's last film before he retired as well. So yeah, Kevin Dillon's kind of had a bit of an impact on me as a probably as a 20 something, I would say Entourage kind of kicked in. So he's been around for the last probably two decades. I'm 40 now. So yeah, probably for the last couple of decades he's been around. So it was great to see him in this film.
Yeah. Yeah, I want to point out at this point that because this film, of course, is based on Oliver Stone's own experiences, wasn't it?
Yeah.
And he's not beyond throwing the odd sort of world old war cliche in there as well, because we get a voiceover at this point.
Yeah. Yeah, and a lot of Charlie Sheen's work in this film is voiceover work.
Yeah. Yeah. And it's you kind of get you hark back and of course to his dad doing the same thing in Apocalypse Now.
Yeah.
And of course there's that great scene in the Hot Shots, was it Hot Shots 2?
Yeah.
Where they're both doing a voiceover on the river. And their boats cross, and it's an absolute genius sequence. I think I loved you in War Street was the punchline or something like that they come out with.
Yeah.
And of course there's another little cliche that made me chuckle at this point where we see one character who's looking at a picture of his girlfriend or his wife, and they're like, uh-oh. That's such a wonderful war cliche. War film cliche.
Yeah, and it's really interesting because there's not a lot going on in the first 20 minutes or so.
No.
We obviously get that bleak opening, and then there's very little script for the first 20 minutes.
Well, it's all character, isn't it? It's introduced to this disparate bunch of colleagues.
Yeah.
And what they're into and what their lives are like. And again, compared to the other film, we get a better snapshots of these guys in the first 20 minutes in the old film of the last film we discussed.
Yeah, it very much feels like we kind of are dropped into what is going on with them. It's not, we don't really need to learn a lot. We can kind of tell by what's happened to them and what is happening to them. We don't need to learn a lot about them as such, because it's kind of there on the screen for us to see from the word go.
Yeah, I mean, I'd written down here about the half hour mark for me that already this film was more interesting for me as a war film than The Hurt Locker.
Yeah.
You want to stay with these guys more. You want to see how these stories play out.
Yeah, and I think that's the difference, because this does actually feel like a war film.
Yeah.
Whereas The Hurt Locker was, we kind of said it was very repetitive that we'd get kind of a scene outside of the war.
Yeah.
With them just kind of hanging around, and then we get the repeated kind of bomb disposal. Yeah. Whereas this, we kind of feel like we're learning more from the action sequences.
Mm.
We kind of get more about their characters and how they react to things.
Yeah.
Within the action sequences that we get. It is still very much that kind of repeat motion of a war. All war films are like that.
Mm.
There's no getting away from it. They're all going to repeat that same action over and over again.
Yeah.
Because that's what a war film is.
Yeah.
It just depends on how they portray those action sequences.
Yeah. As another one, of course, a general thing that Stone throws in at this point is the fact we find out that Taylor was actually a college boy.
Yeah.
Because a lot of people were at college, of course, and would protest and conscientious objectors, etc. But he actually chose to give it up to join up at that point.
Yeah.
Because I think it must have been set before conscription, because I think they did bring in conscription at one point then in the Vietnam War.
Yeah.
But early on, a lot of it was voluntary, volunteers, because they were sold this sort of this message, particular message. And I think that's part of the reason the film works, was the shock and the realization that how shit everything is that he experiences as the film goes on. And particularly that relationship between Defoe and Berenger's characters. And his friendship with Elias, particularly. And I'd written down as well, yeah, the first sort of, oh, yuck, bit of the film for me was a plate with no arms. I think they're in the bunkers.
Yeah.
And
And he
I think
comes
that,
stumbling out.
yeah, and I'd written, oh, no arms, jeez. Oh,
Yeah.
man, so brutal.
Yeah.
And so
And it's the
visceral.
fact that he's still alive.
Yeah, he does live for a few moments, doesn't he? And he's just,
Yeah.
oh, he's, oh, my word.
Yeah.
And the film doesn't hold back, actually, on the
No,
visuals.
it really doesn't. And there's some more scenes, but there's kind of a change of attitude at this point as well, because obviously they look down on Chris. They don't really like him. And it's after this that things start to change for him. And as they say, he is a new character. He's a new person
And
after
there's a
this
change
point.
in tone from the film as well once they get to the village sequence.
Yeah.
And it gets even darker, you can argue. And then this is where we see the sort of the seeds of the Barnes and Elias story playing out, start from here, really, don't they?
Yeah.
Because Barnes is an absolute cunt, basically. He's a
Yeah.
creep tool. And Elias is the complete opposite. He's a realist, but he's also a good man in a shit situation, Elias.
Yeah.
And you feel for him, and you really feel for him at the end with his fate. And from the first time they spark off, you really want to see something happen to Barnes. You want the Barnes situation resolved. And then it's a bit of a shock when it's Taylor that resolves it later on.
Yeah.
When he actually puts him down, but I may have fist bumped a little bit at that point when he does put him down because he's an absolute bastard. And Berenger is so good, and I think credit to Stone for getting that casting spot on of playing them against type because they're both brilliant.
And he probably has probably the horriblest turn.
Yeah, it's the most thankless role in the film, isn't it? The
Yeah,
Berenger part.
once you get to that scene where he shoots the innocent woman, you just know that this isn't gonna turn out well. It's a foul scene. It's horrible, but it's played so well.
And this whole sequence as well is where you see that Dylan's character is a real twat as well.
Yeah.
And it's a great little bit because these moments in the film, like they raise questions about what these guys were like at home. And you imagine that he was a bit of a twat in his own town somewhere as well. But now he's got out into that jungle and he's free to do what he wants.
Yeah, and it really does show what a bunch of dickheads the American soldiers were and still are to this day. I've known people that have been to war with working with the Americans, and they can't do anything. They
Yeah, and
shoot
I
their
mean,
own soldiers and all sorts of things. So this really does portray that in a in a really bright light.
But then what Stone does, and he's not afraid then to flip it and give you some scenes which are completely the opposite, like the bit where Taylor is in with the in the little drug den. It's so funny just to see him taking those first puffs and stuff.
Yeah.
The likes of Elias and one or two of the black guys that are down in there. And they sort of, I you think, how the hell did the military let them build this little sort of drugs den in the jungle?
Yeah, it's very strange, and that everybody's aware of it as well. It's not like it's a hidden thing. Everybody knows what's going
And they're
on.
all talking about it because, like, the lads in the barracks are talking about it as well, aren't they?
Yeah.
About
Yeah.
this weird sort of split was doing the stoners and the rest, basically.
Yeah. What I did want to bring up, I'm really surprised. We talk about how well things are shot and how they look. But what surprised me, for what is a really dark subject, the film is lit really brightly. And I think that's kind of that whole thing of kind of a confusion, isn't it? That you're in the middle of this really horrible thing, but the world is still going on around you, and it does bring a very kind of otherworldly feel to to what is going on. It's
And the fact that a lot of the horrible bits of the film are in the daylight, like the rape sequence, and the execution of the woman. It's all in broad daylight, you know.
It's lit very differently to what you would expect for a war movie.
Yeah, absolutely. And I say, technically, I think it is a really good film. It's not just about the performances, and you can see why the Academy went for this one, and it took home four at least, because it looks great and it sounds great. And like you say, from that we mentioned that opening, when you can feel a film like we did in the first few minutes, you know you're onto a good thing in that respect.
Yeah.
When you feel sweaty and you feel oppressed and you think, well, this film's doing exactly what it's setting out to do. And Stone wants to put you in. If that made that film now with sort of Dolby Atmos and 3D and stuff, it would have been even more uncomfortable.
Yeah, it would have been very, very uncomfortable. That's for sure.
Yeah. There's one of the bits I wrote down in the back end of the film is, where's Depp? Because he just disappears after.
Yeah,
that.
He literally has that one.
Whether his character's died or anything.
Yeah, he disappears. He literally gets that one line in Vietnamese.
In the village, yeah.
And that's it. We don't see him again. And obviously, this is very early on in his career. It's not the depth that we know now by a long shot. Obviously, he was... I don't even think he'd done 21 Jump Street at this point, had he?
Possibly not, no, because this would have been a year or two after Nightmare, I think, because Nightmare was his debut, wasn't it?
Yeah.
Nightmare on Elm Street.
And obviously, we know Depp was a very shy person and didn't really want to be doing this. This wasn't his thing.
Mm.
But then obviously he wanted to be a musician and he just kind of stumbled upon it because he was pretty.
Yeah. And the irony being that he had a great screen presence in the end.
Very, very much so. And and there's not many actors that can do what he does. Mm. Sometimes it doesn't work. But no. Sometimes you just have to look at characters like Edward Scissorhands, Jack Sparrow.
Yeah.
He literally, doesn't matter how much screen time he's got, it's him. It is him. You aren't watching anything else.
Yeah.
But you think, you watch this, and I'd completely forgotten he was in it.
Yeah,
until
likewise,
I caught a glimpse of him, and I was like, oh, it's Johnny Depp. Yeah.
Likewise.
And I was like, well, where is Johnny Depp? And he just he disappears into the background. There's a lot of nodding.
Yeah.
At times,
don't even find out the fate of his character after that big massive ambush or anything.
No.
It was just a weird aside. I thought. I did like the Oliver bunged himself a nice cameo and killed himself off as well.
Yeah. Yeah.
It is a nice sort of kind of in joke that where they, and it's quite brutal that they're just sort of discussing their plans with their next battle sequence and this bloke just suicide bombs the place and they watch.
Yeah.
In fact, that whole ambush sequence at the end of the film is absolutely brutal. I'd forgotten how brutal it was.
Yeah, and how the Willem Dafoe's death is filmed.
Yeah.
From the cops and seeing him in dying on the floor. You never get a close-up of him actually dead. You see him from a distance and that's it. And as I said at the time, to lose the best part of the film at that point is quite difficult because we talk about Johnny Depp disappearing. Charlie Sheen really takes a back seat in the back half of the film. It's truly not about him at all.
No, it is about very much the Barnes and Elias story comes to the fore, doesn't it?
Yeah.
In that last third of the film. And that's what's so why it's doubly shocking then that Taylor is the one that actually puts Barnes down.
Yeah.
And you see what a changed guy, how the war has changed him.
Yeah.
And he doesn't think twice about it. But it's fitting that Barnes has to go out that way because he's such a horrible person.
Yeah.
And the song has to take him out. I think we probably covered a lot of them, the main hit points of the film at that point.
Yeah.
Anything else you wanted to add?
Yeah, just kind of the end does kind of, I did zone out a little bit to the noise of bullet fire.
Mm.
Because there is a lot, at the end, it does become kind of a mess at the end, doesn't it? There's a lot of...
There's a lot going on, yeah, in that last sequence.
Yeah, and it kind of... There is a lot of war in that last bit, and I did kind of zone out. And don't get me wrong, the story, I love... I'm not going to deny, I thought it was a great film. That just that last sequence is a little bit too much at times. And it wasn't as harrowing as I thought it was going to be.
No.
It certainly... It's another one of those war films that's kind of not a war film. It's more of a character piece.
Yeah.
It's not really telling the story of the war. We've obviously had films in recent years. Dunkirk, I would probably say, is more of a war film.
Yeah, they are very much about that sequence and that moment in time, aren't
they? Yeah. Whereas this is more a character piece. And as you say, it's kind of about those two in the end.
Yeah. So it kind of shares a commonality with the Hurt Locker in that respect, that they're both sort of character pieces.
Yeah.
As opposed to the sort of the background, really.
Yeah, definitely. That was kind of my feelings. I just feel this does it better than the Hurt Locker. It kind of melds the two together as such, because, as I say, you find out a lot more about the characters within the set pieces than you do outside of them. Which is really interesting. And obviously there is that iconic piece of music at the end. That we hadn't touched on, that ends on a really good note. And there is a grisly end to it, but there's also a hopeful end to it. Whereas the Hurt Locker kind of thought you had a hopeful end and then it isn't. Whereas this is kind of the other way round.
He gets through his tour, doesn't he? And he's going home and that's him done. I suppose we'll do our wrap up now at this point and our scores. For me, I think it's an incredible, powerful piece of filmmaking from Stone, and probably arguably Stone's best piece of work apart from JFK, maybe. It's got great characters and performances, and it looks and sounds great. Like I say, that whole sweaty atmosphere just seeps out of the screen. And for me, despite not seeing any of the other films, it's more than worthy a winner. It's kind of what I expect from a Best Picture winner, narratively and performance-wise. And probably, certainly one of my top 10 Best Picture winners. And I'm probably going to have to go somewhat really high on this. I think it's a fantastic... Probably 94, maybe 95 even.
Okay, yeah. No, I totally get that. For me, it does have that epic feel of an Oscar winner.
Yeah.
As you say, some great performances. Willem Dafoe is superb in this, and I like him anyway. Obviously, I've grown up knowing him as the Green Goblin, but then we've watched other films with him over the years, and he's superb. No matter what, but this is
he's another one of these actors. Even if the film's terrible, he's often the most interesting thing in it.
Yeah, and even if he's scenery chewing,
yes,
he does it well.
That's
great, and it's great to see Charlie Sheen in a role that isn't comedic. I love Two and a Half Men. I'm not going to lie there. But it's great to see him doing something so dissimilar to anything else that he normally does. It's brilliant to see. I think it's shot well. As you say, you literally feel like you're with them. In Vietnam, it's quite unnerving in that way. And as you say, can you imagine if that was an IMAX screen? You would really feel like you're in it.
The sound as well around you.
Yeah. Just unreal. I'm not going to go quite as high. I'm going to go with an 89.
Yeah, that's good.
Definitely enjoyed it, and I actually think I would go back and watch it again.
Well, as we've done throughout these, this for me is another of the key things about the better winners. Is there something you can pick up from repeated viewing? And most definitely with this, you go back and watch again quite comfortably. Right, I suppose that just leaves us with the next two, and I haven't got my list in front of me now, so I'm going to be guessing.
No getting it right. So the first one I drew was 1952.
52 is going to be something like, oh, what's the one set in Pearl Harbor? Oh, shit, I can't think what it's called. No.
It's an American in Paris.
Oh, it's American in Paris. I was wrong anyway.
Yeah. Yeah. Yep. And then we're going even further back. We're going to 1933.
Grand Hotel.
Well done. It is.
Yeah, that was still in my mind from watching the apartment.
Yeah. Yep. So there are two for next month. A couple of oldies.
Those are going to be first time watches.
Yeah, cool. Definitely.
Cool. Right. Well, that just leaves me to say thank you for joining me. And thank you all for listening. And we will see you again next month.